I try to tell him about the fragrance of the woods in the springtime and of all the beauty of this world, which just can't register on him because he just doesn't have my sensory mechanism. We do a lot of talking and I never get any answers. But that's not his fault. I can talk, but you see, I happen to be deaf.
Yeah, I love that. Don't you get answers by feeling much better after you have talked?
Feelings, yes, but not words. And if I ever heard words, they would frighten me half out of my wits. I would immediately consult a competent psychiatrist and tell him I was on the verge of paranoia. One thing which has intrigued me, I've been very interested in the people who are interested in this book. And as a group, they've had good humor. They have not taken themselves seriously. Or if they've had a touch of this, it hasn't lasted very long. I once told a group that I had to do with for a long time, I said, if this group ever loses its ability to laugh at funny things, and that includes ourselves because human beings are indescribably funny, if this group ever starts taking themselves seriously, I said, I'm going to pay you the supreme insult. I'm going to pray for you in public and to your faces. This is no more insulting thing could be done to people. No, the folks that have seemed to take an interest in this have been average people. I'm a management consultant by trade. I make my living solving business problems. And I'm probably one of the most improbable persons to be associated with a religious movement that you could ever meet. There's nothing hierarchical about me, you know. I can teach pretty well, but preaching is not in me. You want me to read you some more from the book? Let me read you some passages. The English is very lovely. There is in the mind of God a plan which embraces every creature of all his vast domains. And this plan is an eternal purpose of boundless opportunity, unlimited progress, and endless life. And the infinite treasures of such a matchless career are yours for the choosing. The goal of eternity is ahead. The adventure of divinity attainment lies before you. The race for perfection is on. Whosoever will may enter, and certain victory will crown the efforts of every human being who will run the race of faith and trust, depending every step of the way on the leading of the indwelling Spirit of God and on the guidance of that good Spirit of His Son, which so freely has been poured out upon all flesh. This book is written like music. It's not written like a textbook, which adds somewhat to our problems in studying it, because when we study it intellectually, we want to make a textbook out of it. But this book actually is written the way a symphony is written. This book introduces major themes, minor themes. They reappear in different keys, in different tempos, with different expressions. So, could I read you the overture which contains the principal movement of this very lovely symphony? This is the movement that runs all the way through and keeps repairing. This is the introduction to paper one. That's right where an overture would be. You'd expect to find it. The Universal Father is the God of all creation, the first source and center of all things and beings, First, think of God as a creator, then as a controller, and lastly, as an infinite upholder. The truth about the Universal Father had begun to dawn upon mankind when the prophet said, "You, God, are alone. There is none beside you. You have created the heaven and the heaven of heavens with all their hosts. You preserve and control them. By the sons of God were the universes made. The Creator covers himself with light, as with a garment, and stretches out the heavens as a curtain." Only the concept of the Universal Father, one God in the place of many gods, enabled mortal man to comprehend the Father as divine creator and infinite controller. The myriads of planetary systems were all made to be eventually inhabited by many different types of intelligent creatures, beings who could know God, receive the divine affection, and love him in return. The universe of universes is the work of God and the dwelling place of his diverse creatures. God created the heavens and formed the earth. He established the universe and created this world not in vain. He formed it to be inhabited. The enlightened worlds all recognize and worship the Universal Father, the eternal maker and infinite upholder of all creation. The will creatures of universe upon universe have embarked upon the long paradise journey, the fascinating struggle of the eternal adventure of attaining God the Father. The transcendent goal of the children of time is to find the eternal God, to comprehend the divine nature, to recognize the Universal Father. God-knowing creatures have only one supreme ambition, just one consuming desire, and that is to become as they are in their spheres, like him, as he is in his paradise perfection of personality, and in his universal sphere of righteous supremacy. From the Universal Father, who inhabits eternity, there has gone forth the supreme mandate: be you perfect, even as I am perfect. In love and mercy, the messengers of paradise have carried this divine exhortation down through the ages and out through the universes, even to such lowly animal origin creatures as the human races of Urantia. This magnificent and universal injunction to strive for the attainment of the perfection of divinity is the first duty and should be the highest ambition of all the struggling creature creation of the God of perfection. This possibility of the attainment of divine perfection is the final and certain destiny of all man's eternal spiritual progress. Urantia mortals can hardly hope to be perfect in the infinite sense, but it is entirely possible for human beings, starting out as they do on this planet, to attain the supernal and divine goal which the infinite God has set for mortal men. And when they do achieve this destiny, they will, in all that pertains to self-realization and mind attainment, be just as replete in their sphere of divine perfection as God himself is in his sphere of infinity and eternity. Such perfection may not be universal in the material sense, unlimited in intellectual grasp, or final in spiritual experience, but it is final and complete in all finite aspects of divinity of will, perfection of personality motivation, and God consciousness. This is the true meaning of that divine command: be you perfect, even as I am perfect, which ever urges mortal man onward and beckons him inward in that long and fascinating struggle for the attainment of higher and higher levels of spiritual values and true universe meanings. This sublime search for the God of universes is the supreme adventure of the inhabitants of all the worlds of time and space. This is the major thing. Yes.
At page 21, I think.
Slightly paraphrasing. Let me read you from the last page in the book, where the theme is closed. Be not discouraged. Human evolution is still in progress. And the revelation of God to the world in and through Jesus shall not fail. The great challenge to modern man is to achieve better communication with the Spirit of God that dwells within the human mind. Man's greatest adventure in the flesh consists in the well-balanced and sane effort to advance the borders of self-consciousness out through the dim realms of embryonic soul consciousness in a wholehearted effort to reach the borderland of spirit consciousness, contact with the divine presence. Such an experience constitutes God consciousness, an experience mightily confirmative of the pre-existent truth of the religious experience of knowing God. Such spirit consciousness is the equivalent of the knowledge of the actuality of sonship with God. Otherwise, the assurance of sonship is the experience of faith. And God consciousness is equivalent to the integration of the self with the universe and on its highest levels of spiritual reality. Only the spirit content of any value is imperishable. Even that which is true and beautiful and good may not perish in human experience. If man does not choose to survive, then does the indwelling Spirit of God conserve those realities born of love and nurtured in service. And all these things are a part of the Universal Father. The Father is living love, and this life of the Father is in His sons, and the Spirit of the Father is in His sons' sons, mortal man. When all is said and done, the Father idea is still the highest human concept of God. That's the opening and closing theme of the most fascinating symphony I've ever read. It is a symphony. It's symphonic in its construction.
Did you say that it was written in 1930?
That's the dating of the papers, yes. Mid-30s. I think, is it 34?
34.
34 and 35. 35. I haven't checked those dates in a long time.
And you said at that time it would be better understood because of radio.
Yes, I've often thought, why did they do this now? It's a good question. Well, I don't think they could have written this much before the development of wireless. We had to get our science going. Example, they mention that scene in the book of Daniel when he saw the Ancient of Days seated on the throne and his hair and beard were like carded wool, and out of the throne came thunder and lightnings. They tell us that's the universe communication broadcasts. Now, until we have the word broadcast, until we know about electricity, we're going to be stuck where Daniel was when they showed him a broadcast He did the best he could. He interpreted it in terms of all the electricity he knew, which was lightning. I think old Daniel was pretty bright to make that interpretation. And then, of course, as I look the world over, I can see why a book like this might appear. We are, I guess to use a service expression, it's gotten beyond snafu, it's fubar. Snafu, you know, is fouled up beyond all recognition. No, snafu is situation normal, all fouled up, and fubar is fouled up beyond all recognition or recovery. Yes.
Now my questions are all very beginner's questions.
Of course.
Interested in, especially with the conflict of the church or how the church represents Jesus. Now, what does this book give as the main reason that Jesus was sent? Now the sonship that
oh, yes.
we read last time.
What were his reasons for coming here?
Yeah, the purpose for his coming.
This book teaches very few negative points. But this book simply states that to believe that God was mad at us is blasphemous.
Yeah.
Anger in a father is hardly a credit to a human father, much less a divine father. Jesus had his own reasons for coming here, and I can give them to you briefly. He was earning sovereignty. A sovereignty over a part of this wide-spreading universe. As the papers instruct me, his domain will eventually embrace 10 million inhabited worlds, of which this is one. He's been working at this for the last 400 billion years, and he's much older than this. He's a paradise, creator son of God. He's not a creature. He's a creator. He came here because until he had demonstrated his right to rule, he could rule only in the name of his Father, by divine right, not by experiential right. This was the seventh episode in his experiencing the life of the creature. And the first time he was born and died. The other six preceding episodes in the earning of sovereignty did not have to do with human beings. He came here and he was born because it was his objective to find out exactly what it was like to be a human being. And birth is a normal part, an inescapable part of the human experience. He accepted death because death also is a normal part of the human experience. The manner of his dying was contrived by men. It was not the will of God. It was the will of God that he meet death, but not a peculiarly cruel death. Before he began his public ministry, he had earned his sovereignty. So that he had nothing more to gain by staying here the last 4 years. This was a free will gift which he made to the human race. And his purpose during his public ministry, which is all we know about, except the few episodes at the time of his birth and when he was in Jerusalem at 12, his purpose those 4 years was to paint the perfect anthropomorphic picture of an infinite Father. He lived as God himself would have lived, were God flesh and blood. He wasn't trying to live as himself, but as a son of God, with the divinity potential to reveal God, he simply lived the life which God would live, were God a flesh and blood mortal. Thus making God real and understandable to man. As the papers teach, Jesus' life is greater than Jesus' teachings. You can live the truth, more effectively than you can speak it. That's what they teach about the purpose Jesus had in coming.
Now that is the idea of the church, that he is our savior and died for us.
Yes,
sins.
I know.
A little bit twisted.
The gospel that Jesus taught is God is your father. God is the father of each man. Hence, all men are brothers and should treat each other accordingly. The gospel of the church is have fellowship with the risen Lord through membership in the church and accept deliverance from death because he died for us. This story got warped unintentionally by Peter on the day of Pentecost. Peter didn't mean to do this. You know, they're so kind to the people that made mistakes. They weren't deliberate mistakes. Jesus had warned the 12 to preach what he was preaching about God. But on the day of Pentecost, the 12 were so overjoyed about the risen Christ that they preached about Jesus instead of about God. And this was the great diversion of the Jesusonian gospel into the Christian gospel. Yes? Keep on asking questions.
Yeah.
You're asking all the questions that some of these other folks maybe you're too timid to ask.
I didn't understand this question.
Yes?
The Jesusonian gospel, with other words, Peter twisted.
Yes.
The God message.
Yes.
Christ, really, Jesus Christ brought.
Yes.
And made it a Jesus gospel.
Yes, exactly. Jesus was no egotist.
No, that's so terrible.
As the papers, isn't that terrible? But Peter was bubbling over with the good news, and Peter was an impetuous extrovert. And gosh, it worked. It was exciting news. As the Blue Book says, it's the second best gospel the world has ever heard. The best gospel is the one the carpenter himself taught.
And it is so amazing what the church did. Jesus said, I have to leave, because he knew this. But I send you my counselor.
Yes.
And what did the church twisted that all around?
That's right. The trouble really starts with Paul. And well, what we have is a mix. May I read you about Christianity? You like to hear it?
Yes.
This is quite some rhetoric now. So hang on to your intellectual seats. I'll read you the conclusion of next to the last paper. Christianity has indeed done a great service for this world, but what is now most needed is Jesus. The world needs to see Jesus living again on earth in the experience of spirit-born mortals who effectively reveal the Master to all men. It is futile to talk about a revival of primitive Christianity. You must go forward from where you find yourself. Modern culture must become spiritually baptized with a new revelation of Jesus' life and illuminated with a new understanding of his gospel of eternal salvation. And when Jesus becomes thus lifted up, he will draw all men to himself. Jesus' disciples should be more than conquerors, even overflowing sources of inspiration and enhanced living to all men. Religion is only an exalted humanism until it is made divine by the discovery of the reality of the presence of God in personal experience. The beauty and sublimity, the humanity and divinity, the simplicity and uniqueness of Jesus' life on earth presents such a striking and appealing picture of man-saving and God-revealing that the theologians and philosophers of all time should be effectively restrained from daring to form creeds or create theological systems of spiritual bondage out of such a transcendental bestowal of God in the form of man. In Jesus, the universe produced a mortal man in whom the spirit of love triumphed over the material handicaps of time and overcame the fact of physical origin. Ever bear in mind, God and men need each other. They are mutually necessary to the full and final attainment of eternal personality experience in the divine destiny of universe finality. The kingdom of God is within you was probably the greatest pronouncement Jesus ever made, next to the declaration that his Father is a living and loving spirit. In winning souls for the Master, it is not the first mile of compulsion, duty, or convention that will transform man and his world, but rather the second mile of free service and liberty-loving devotion that betokens the Jesusonian reaching forth to grasp his brother in love and sweep him on under spiritual guidance towards the higher and divine goal of mortal existence. Christianity even now willingly goes the first mile, but mankind languishes and stumbles along in moral darkness because there are so few genuine second milers, so few professed followers of Jesus who really live and love as he taught his disciples to live and love and serve. The call to the adventure of building a new and transformed human society by means of the spiritual rebirth of Jesus' brotherhood of the kingdom should thrill all who believe in him, as men have not been stirred since the days when they walked about on earth as his companions in the flesh. No social system or political regime which denies the reality of God can contribute in any constructive and lasting manner to the advancement of human civilization. But Christianity, as it is subdivided and secularized today, presents the greatest single obstacle to its further advancement. Especially is this true concerning the Orient.
What?
The Orient. Ecclesiasticism is at once and forever incompatible with that living faith, growing spirit, and first-hand experience of the faith comrades of Jesus in the brotherhood of man, in the spiritual association of the kingdom of heaven. The praiseworthy desire to preserve traditions of past achievement often leads to the defense of outgrown systems of worship. The well-meant desire to foster ancient thought systems effectually prevents the sponsoring of new and adequate means and methods designed to satisfy the spiritual longings of the expanding and advancing minds of modern men. Christianity is seriously confronted with the doom embodied in one of its own slogans: a house divided against itself cannot stand. The non-Christian world will hardly capitulate to a sect-divided Christendom. The living Jesus is the only hope of a possible unification of Christianity. The true church, the Jesus Brotherhood, is invisible, spiritual, and is characterized by unity, not necessarily by uniformity. But the Christianity of even the 20th century must not be despised. It is the product of the combined moral genius of the God-knowing men of many races during many ages, and it has been truly one of the greatest powers for good on earth, and therefore no man should lightly regard it, notwithstanding its inherent and acquired defects. Christianity still contrives to move the minds of reflective men with mighty moral emotions. But there is no excuse for the involvement of the church in commerce and politics. Such unholy alliances are a flagrant betrayal of the Master. and the genuine lovers of truth will be slow to forget that this powerful institutionalized church has often dared to smother newborn faith and persecute truth bearers who chance to appear in unorthodox raiment. It is all too true that such a church would not have survived unless there had been men in the world who preferred such a style of worship. Many spiritually indolent souls crave an ancient and authoritative religion of ritual and sacred traditions. Human evolution and spiritual progress are hardly sufficient to enable all men to dispense with religious authority. And the invisible brotherhood of the kingdom may well include those family groups of various social and temperamental classes if they are only willing to become truly spirit-led sons of God. But in this brotherhood of Jesus, there is no place for sectarian rivalry, group bitterness, nor assertions of moral superiority and spiritual infallibility. These various groupings of Christians may serve to accommodate numerous different types of would-be believers among the various peoples of Western civilization, but such a division of Christendom presents a grave weakness when it attempts to carry the gospel of Jesus to Oriental peoples. These races do not yet understand that there is a religion of Jesus, separate and somewhat apart from Christianity, which has more and more become a religion about Jesus. Christianity is an extemporized religion, and therefore must it operate in low gear. High gear spiritual performances must await the new revelation and the more general acceptance of the real religion of Jesus. But Christianity is a mighty religion, seeing that the commonplace disciples of a crucified carpenter set in motion those teachings which conquered the Roman world in 300 years, and then went on to triumph over the barbarians who overthrew Rome. This same Christianity conquered, absorbed, and exalted the whole stream of Hebrew theology and Greek philosophy. And then when this Christian religion became comatose for more than 1,000 years as a result of an overdose of mysteries and paganism, it resurrected itself and virtually reconquered the whole Western world. Christianity contains enough of Jesus' teachings to immortalize. If Christianity could only grasp more of Jesus' teachings, it could do so much more in helping modern man to solve his new and increasingly complex problems. Christianity suffers under a great handicap because it has become identified in the minds of all the world as a part of the social system, the industrial life, and the moral standards of Western civilization. And thus has Christianity unwittingly seemed to sponsor a society which staggers under the guilt of tolerating science without idealism, politics without principles, wealth without work, pleasure without restraint, knowledge without character, power without conscience, and industry without morality. The hope of modern Christianity is that it should cease to sponsor the social systems and industrial policies of Western civilization, while it humbly bows itself before the cross it so valiantly extols, there to learn anew from Jesus of Nazareth the greatest truths mortal man can ever hear, the living gospel of the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of men. The English is very interesting, isn't it? as the teenagers say today, it swings.
Mel?
Yes.
Going back to the Orient, it fascinates me because I was never acquainted with a Buddhist before, but we had a Buddhist student in our home.
Yes.
Delightful boy.
You'd be very interested.
We had an Arab boy.
Ah, yes.
Those boys are awakening, and we didn't preach to them at all, but we listened and we enjoyed them and loved them. And I guess there are ways, because the Arab boy certainly displayed great resentment and all in pictures that he was an artist that he drew. But the last one that he painted and he left had an entirely different countenance than the first. We discussed this before. The Cambodian boy was the Buddhist, and he is... They saw the picture.
Cambodian. He's Hinayana Buddhist. He's fundamentalist Buddhist.
Is that right?
Yes. That's in contrast to Northern Buddhism.
Oh.
Which is Protestant Buddhism, you might say.
Very interesting comments that they've made since they're here. So I would say the best awakening will come through their exposure to Western Christianity.
Could be. Would you like me to? Yes.
I was just going to say this could be very naive and wrong, but I'll say it anyway.
Don't apologize, just ask. We're all neophytes,
this, you know. It seems to me, and it's just a very smattering of reading of East and Western religions, that actually they're all trying to say the same thing.
Sure they are.
In their own terms.
Yes.
And so as such, sometimes the word Christianity, and when you hear it used by, say, a Western leader, I think it's a word that should not be used, because it immediately, publicly, it sounds as if you're being sanctimonious,
mm-hmm.
and the great, to me, and that can be all wrong, but I wondered about it, because it's discounting.
But is there not a difference of active and passive religion? I mean, the Buddhist is much more in the passive concept of...
That's true of Hinayana Buddhism, but hardly of the Mahayana. That's not as true of Northern Buddhism as it would be of original or fundamentalist Buddhism, Hinayana Buddhism.
Yeah.
The Buddhism of Burma, Cambodia, Ceylon, in contrast to the Buddhism of Japan, which is a more active Buddhism. There's some contemplation there, too. Zen is more contemplative. Shin, less so. That's like saying, you know, that the Congregationalists are more liberal, perhaps, than the Episcopalians, High Church. The papers have this to say about different religions. They have, on the preceding page, taken inventory, and they do it chronologically. First Hinduism, the most ancient, then the Hebrew religion, Buddhism, the Confucian teachings, the Taoist beliefs, Zoroastrianism, Shinto, Jainism, Christianity, Islam, and Sikhism, the most recent. They have this to say: the many religions of Urantia are all good to the extent that they bring man to God and bring the realization of the Father to man. It is a fallacy for any group of religionists to conceive of their creed as the truth. Such attitudes bespeak more of theological arrogance than certainty of faith. There is not a Urantia religion that could not profitably study and assimilate the best of the truths contained in every other faith, for all contain truth. Religionists would do better to borrow the best in their neighbor's living spiritual faith, rather than to denounce the worst in their lingering superstitions and outworn rituals. You know, I do some talking here and there, and occasionally in churches, And once I was asked to, take a little church up in Wisconsin over for a day. And my pal, the Presbyterian minister, told me to do the sermon as well. And so I dug into my library of comparative religion, and I wove a sermon out of direct quotes from so-called pagan texts. I took only one editorial license. Whatever word they had for God, I used a familiar word like God, the Lord, the Almighty, you know. Afterwards, almost everybody came up and shook my hand and wanted to know the source of the sermon. But I just wasn't going to tell them. This would have been too shocking to that congregation. But this was all paganism I was preaching in a Christian altar. And I want to tell you something. It was a beautiful sermon because I didn't write it. I just compiled it. Would you like me to read you something from the life of Jesus? Pick the year you'd like to hear about. You want it when he was a little boy, when he was a teenager, when he was growing up? Let me read you. Can I read you a little story from school days, if I can find it? This is fun. I read you about his 10th year. This is the 10th year, AD 4. He was born 7 BC on August 21st. If I believed in the signs of the zodiac, I would say that's an auspicious day. He's now 10 years old, and this is AD 4. It was the 5th of July, this first Sabbath of the month, when Jesus, while strolling through the countryside with his father, first gave expressions to feelings and ideas which indicated that he was becoming self-conscious of the unusual nature of his life mission. Joseph listened attentively to the momentous words of his son, but made few comments. He volunteered no information. The next day, Jesus had a similar but longer talk with his mother. Mary likewise listened to the pronouncements of the lad, but neither did she volunteer any information. It was almost 2 years before Jesus again spoke to his parents concerning this increasing revelation within his own consciousness regarding the nature of his personality and the character of his mission on earth. He entered the advanced school of the synagogue in August. At school, he was constantly creating trouble for the questions he persisted in asking. Increasingly, he kept all Nazareth in more or less of a hubbub. His parents were loath to forbid his asking these disquieting questions, and his chief teacher was greatly intrigued by the lad's curiosity, insight, and hunger for knowledge. Jesus' playmates saw nothing supernatural in his conduct. In most ways, he was altogether like themselves. His interest in study was somewhat above the average, but not wholly unusual. He did ask more questions at school than others in his class. Perhaps his most unusual and outstanding trait was his unwillingness to fight for his rights. since he was such a well-developed lad for his age, it seemed strange to his playfellows that he was disinclined to defend himself even from injustice when subjected to personal abuse. As it happened, he did not suffer much on account of this trait, because of the friendship of Jacob, a neighbor boy who was 1 year older. He was the son of the stonemason, a business associate of Joseph. Jacob was a great admirer of Jesus and made it his business to see that no one was permitted to impose upon Jesus because of his aversion to physical combat. Several times older and uncouth youths attacked Jesus, relying upon his reputed docility, but they always suffered swift and certain retribution at the hands of his self-appointed champion and ever-ready defender, Jacob the stonemason's son. Jesus was the generally accepted leader of the Nazareth lads, who stood for the highest ideals of their day and generation. He was really loved by his youthful associates, not only because he was fair, but also because he possessed a rare and understanding sympathy that betokened on love and bordered on discreet compassion. This year, he began to show a marked preference for the company of older persons. He delighted in talking over things cultural, educational, social, economic, political, and religious with older minds. And his depth of reasoning and keenness of observation so charmed his adult associates that they were always more than willing to visit with him. Until he became responsible for the support of the home, his parents were constantly seeking to influence him to associate with those of his own age, or more nearly his age, rather than with older, better informed individuals for whom he evinced such a preference. Late this year, he had a fishing experience of 2 months with his uncle on the Sea of Galilee, and he was very successful. Before attaining manhood, he had become an expert fisherman. His physical development continued. He was an advanced and privileged pupil at school. He got along fairly well at home with his younger brothers and sisters, having the advantage of being 3 1/2 years older than the oldest of the other children. He was well thought of in Nazareth, except for the parents of some of the duller children, who often spoke of Jesus as being too pert, as lacking in proper humility and youthful reserve. Human nature hasn't changed very much, has it? He manifested a growing tendency to direct the play activities of his youthful associates into more serious and thoughtful channels. He was a born teacher and simply could not refrain from so functioning even when supposedly engaged in play. Joseph early began to instruct Jesus in the diverse means of gaining a livelihood, explaining the advantages of agriculture over industry and trade. Galilee was a more beautiful and prosperous district than Judea, and it cost only about 1/4 as much to live there as in Jerusalem and Judea. It was a province of agricultural villages and thriving industrial cities, containing more than 200 towns of over 5,000 population and 30 of over 15,000. When on his first trip with his father to observe the fishing industry on the Lake of Galilee, Jesus had just about made up his mind to become a fisherman. But close association with his father's vocation later on influenced him to become a carpenter, while still later a combination of influences led him to the final choice of becoming a religious teacher of a new order. Let's read about his 15th year. This is 89. Are you interested in this?
Yes.
Fine. By the middle of his 15th year, and we are reckoning time in accordance with the 20th century calendar, not with the Jewish year, Jesus had taken a firm grasp upon the management of his family. His father died the preceding year, was killed accidentally. Before this year had passed, their savings had about disappeared. and they were face to face with the necessity of disposing of one of the Nazareth houses which Joseph and his neighbor Jacob owned in partnership. Joseph was more than a carpenter. At the time of his death, he was a rather prosperous contractor. On Wednesday evening, April 17th, 89, Ruth, the baby of the family, was born. And to the best of his ability, Jesus endeavored to take the place of his father in comforting and ministering to his mother during this trying and peculiarly sad ordeal. For almost a score of years until he began his public ministry, no father could have loved and nurtured his daughter any more affectionately and faithfully than Jesus cared for little Ruth. And he was an equally good father to all the other members of his family. During this year, Jesus first formulated the prayer which he subsequently taught his apostles, and which to many has become known as the Lord's Prayer. In a way, it was an evolution of the family altar. They had many forms of praise and several formal prayers. After his father's death, Jesus tried to teach the older children to express themselves individually in prayer, much as he so enjoyed doing, but they could not grasp his thought and would invariably fall back upon their memorized prayer forms. It was in this effort to stimulate his older brothers and sisters to say individual prayers that Jesus would endeavor to lead them along by suggestive phrases, and presently, without intention on his part, it developed that they were all using a form of prayer which was largely built up from these suggestive lines which Jesus had taught them. At last, Jesus gave up the idea of having each member of the family formulate spontaneous prayers, and one evening in October, he sat down with a little squat lamp on the low stone table and on a piece of smooth cedar board about 18 inches square with a piece of charcoal. He wrote out the prayer, which became from that time on the standard family petition. Would you like me to read you that prayer? It's given elsewhere in the book. Does anybody know quickly where it is? I've got it here. Lucky. I'm lucky I've got it.
1620.
Yeah. Our Father, who is in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our bread for tomorrow. Refresh our souls with the water of life. And forgive everyone, and forgive us everyone our debts, as we also have forgiven our debtors. Save us in temptation. Deliver us from evil. And increasingly, make us perfect like yourself. Very close to what we have. This year, Jesus was much troubled with confused thinking. Family responsibilities had quite effectively removed all thought of immediately carrying out any plan for responding to the Jerusalem visitation, directing him to be about his Father's business. Jesus rightly reckoned that the watch care of his earthly family must take precedence of all duties, that the support of his family must become his first obligation. In the course of this year, Jesus found a passage in the so-called Book of Enoch, which influenced him later in the adoption of the term Son of Man as a designation for his bestowal mission on Urantia. He had thoroughly considered the idea of the Jewish Messiah and was firmly convinced that he was not to be that Messiah. He longed to help his father's people, but he never expected to lead Jewish armies in overthrowing the foreign domination of Palestine. He knew he would never sit on the throne of David at Jerusalem. Neither did he believe that his mission was that of a spiritual deliverer or moral teacher solely to the Jewish people. In no sense, therefore, could his life mission be the fulfillment of the intense longings and supposed messianic prophecies of the Hebrew Scriptures, at least not as the Jews understood these predictions of the prophets. Likewise, he was certain that he was never to appear as the Son of Man depicted by the prophet Daniel. But when the time came for him to go forth as a world teacher, what would he call himself? What claim should he make concerning his mission? By what name would he be called by the people who would become believers in his teaching? The great confusion of Jesus' younger days now arose. Having settled something about the nature of his mission on earth to be about his Father's business, to show forth his Father's loving nature to all mankind, he began to ponder anew the many statements in the scriptures referring to the coming of a national deliverer, a Jewish teacher or king. To what event did these prophecies refer? Was he not a Jew, or was he? Was he or was he not of the house of David? His mother averred he was. His father had ruled, but he was not. He decided he was not. But had the prophets confused the nature and mission of the Messiah? His profound periods of meditation, his frequent journeys to the hilltop for prayer, and the many ideas which Jesus advanced from time to time thoroughly alarmed his mother. Sometimes she thought the lad was beside himself, and then she would steady her fears, remembering that he was, after all, a child of promise, and in some manner different from other youths. But Jesus was learning not to speak of all his thoughts, not to present all his ideas to the world, not even to his own mother. From this year on, Jesus' disclosures about what was going on in his mind steadily diminished. That is, he talked less about those things which an average person could not grasp and which would lead to his being regarded as peculiar or different from ordinary folks. To all appearances, he became commonplace and conventional, though he did long for someone who could understand his problems. He craved a trustworthy and confidential friend, but his problems were too complex for his human associates to comprehend. The uniqueness of the unusual situation compelled him to bear his problems alone. Gradually, Jesus and his family returned to the simple life of their earlier years. Their clothes and even their food became simpler. They had plenty of milk, butter, and cheese. In season, they enjoyed the produce of their garden. But each passing month necessitated the practice of greater frugality. Their breakfasts were very plain. They saved their best food for the evening meal. However, among these Jews, lack of wealth did not imply social inferiority. Already had this youth well nigh encompassed the comprehension of how men lived in his day, and how well he understood life in the home, field, and workshop is shown by his subsequent teachings, which so repletely reveal his intimate contact with all phases of human experience. The Nazareth Kazan continued to cling to the belief that Jesus was to become a great teacher, probably the successor of the renowned Gamaliel at Jerusalem. Apparently, all Jesus' plans for a career were thwarted. The future did not look bright as matters now developed, but he did not falter. He was not discouraged. He lived on day by day, doing well the present duty and faithfully discharging the immediate responsibilities of his station in life. Jesus' life is the everlasting comfort of all disappointed idealists. The pay of a common day laboring carpenter was slowly diminishing. By the end of this year, Jesus could earn, by working early and late, only the equivalent of about 25 cents a day. But by the next year, they found it difficult to pay the civil taxes, not to mention the synagogue assessments and the temple tax of 1/2 shekel. During this year, the tax collector tried to squeeze extra revenue out of Jesus, even threatening to take his heart. Fearing that the copy of the Greek scriptures might be discovered and confiscated by the tax collectors, Jesus, on his 15th birthday, presented it to the Nazareth Synagogue Library, as his maturity offering to the Lord. The great shock of his 15th year came when Jesus went over to Sepphoris to receive the decision of Herod regarding the appeal taken to him in the dispute about the amount of money due Joseph at the time of his accidental death. Jesus and Mary hoped for the receipt of a considerable sum of money when the treasurer at Sepphoris had offered them a paltry amount. Joseph's brothers had taken an appeal to Herod himself, and now Jesus stood in the palace and heard Herod decree that his father had nothing due him at the time of his death. And for such an unjust decision, Jesus never again trusted Herod Antipas. It is not surprising that he once alluded to Herod as that fox. The close work at the carpenter's bench during this and subsequent years deprived Jesus of the opportunity of mingling with the caravan passengers. The family supply shop had already been taken over by his uncle, and Jesus worked altogether at the home shop, where he was near to help Mary with the family. About this time, he began sending James, that's his oldest brother, up to the camel lot to gather information about world events, and thus he sought to keep in touch with the news of the day. As he grew up to manhood, he passed through all those conflicts and confusions which the average young persons of previous and subsequent ages have undergone. And the rigorous experience of supporting his family was a sure safeguard against his having overmuch time for idle meditation or the indulgence of mystic tendencies. This was the year Jesus rented a considerable piece of land just to the north of their home, which was divided up as a family garden plot. Each of the older children had an individual garden, and they entered into keen competition in their agricultural efforts. Their eldest brother spent some time with them in the garden each day during the season of vegetable cultivation. As Jesus worked with his younger brothers and sisters in the garden, he many times entertained the wish that they were all located on a farm out in the country, where they could enjoy the liberty and freedom of an unhampered life. But they did not find themselves growing up in the country, and Jesus, being a thoroughly practical youth as well as an idealist, intelligently and vigorously attacked his problem just as he found it, and did everything within his power to adjust himself and the family to the realities of their situation, and to adapt their condition to the highest possible satisfaction of their individual and collective longings. At one time, Jesus faintly hoped that he might be able to gather up sufficient means, provided they could collect the considerable sum of money due his father for work on Herod's palace, to warrant undertaking the purchase of a small farm. He'd really given serious thought to this plan of moving his family out into the country. But when Herod refused to pay them any of the funds due Joseph, they gave up the ambition of owning a home in the country. As it was, they contrived to enjoy much of the experience of farm life, as they now had 3 cows, 4 sheep, a flock of chickens, a donkey, and a dog, in addition to the doves. Even the little tots had their regular duties to perform in the well-regulated scheme of management which characterized the home life of this Nazareth family. With the close of this 15th year, Jesus completed the traversal of that dangerous and difficult period of human existence, that time of transition between the more complacent years of childhood and the consciousness of approaching manhood, with its increased responsibilities and opportunities for the acquirement of advanced experience in the development of a noble character. The growing period for mind and body had ended. And now began the real career of this young man of Nazareth. Those chairs must be getting hard.
Bill, shouldn't we stop? Just said yes. There wouldn't be much juvenile delinquency if families are raising their children that way.
No, that's right. They were busy. Isn't that a lovely story?
Yeah. It's in this book also when Jesus began to do the miracles, and it said, is it explained how these miracles happened?
And which ones didn't happen, and some of them did. He was, after all, a creator.
Yeah. And it is
just to intrigue you. The widow's son at Nain was not dead. He was in a coma. And when Jesus tried to tell the group that he wasn't dead, and he was merely averting a tragedy, the burying of a live person, they simply said, "Look at him, isn't he modest?" You see, they were miracle-minded. They would read a miracle into any event. But Lazarus was dead and had been dead for 3 days in bodily corruption, it said. That was really something. You know, they look for miracles. If I saw one, I wouldn't believe it. I'd look for the mirrors and the piano wires, and I'd say, Houdini or Thurston's around here somewhere. We're a skeptical generation. Should we? Yes.
Where was Lazarus' soul during that period?
His guardian angel had it. And the Father's indwelling spirit had received prior orders to stand by. And as the papers point out, the technical restoration of Lazarus' physical body was a much tougher job for the biologists and the technicians that had to do it than it would be to do the normal thing, taking him on to the mansion world. This involved the actual reconstruction of Lazarus' body. And they did such a beautiful job of reconstruction that many, many years later, when he died of the same thing the second time. They rebuilt the weakness. It was a true restoration. When you read about the host of personalities that are down here, this was worse than a World Series, you know. Anybody in this universe that could get the transit was down here watching this. And they had plenty of technically competent people. I'll tell you, I think the most... Want me to read you about the water and the wine at Cana?
Yes.
Can you take more?
Hmm? The wedding day. The
marriage feast of Cana.
Is that true?
You know?
Sure.
I remember the first time I read this paper, and I knew it wasn't going to happen. It's such a cute story, and I think it is sublimely humorous. Yes. No, this isn't too bad, too long. You see, the news is kind of broken, and Jesus has become by now a minor celebrity in the environs of Nazareth. By noon on Wednesday, almost 1,000 guests had arrived in Cana, more than 4 times the number bidden to the wedding feast. It was the Jewish customs to celebrate weddings on Wednesday, and the invitations had been sent abroad for the wedding 1 month previously. In the forenoon and early afternoon, it appeared more like a public reception for Jesus than a wedding. Everyone wanted to greet this near-famous Galilean. And he was most cordial to all, young and old, Jew and Gentile. And everybody rejoiced when Jesus consented to lead the preliminary wedding procession. Jesus was now thoroughly self-conscious regarding his human existence, his divine pre-existence, and the status of his combined or fused human and divine natures. With perfect poise, he could at one moment enact the human role, or immediately assume the personality prerogatives of the divine nature. As the day wore on, Jesus became increasingly conscious that the people were expecting him to perform some wonder. More especially, he recognized that his family and his 6 disciple apostles, the other 6 were yet to be chosen, were looking for him appropriately to announce his forthcoming kingdom by some startling and supernatural manifestation. Early in the afternoon, Mary summoned James, and together they made bold to approach Jesus to inquire if he would admit them to his confidence, to the extent of informing them at what hour and at what point in connection with wedding ceremonies he had planned to manifest himself as the supernatural one. On the way to Cana, it says, Mary had not been so joyous in years. She journeyed to Cana in the spirit of the Queen Mother on the way to witness the coronation of her son. No sooner had they spoken of these matters to Jesus than they saw they had aroused his characteristic indignation. He said only, "If you love me, then be willing to tarry with me, while I wait upon the will of my Father who is in heaven." But the eloquence of his rebuke lay in the expression of his face. This move of his mother was a great disappointment to the human Jesus, and he was much sobered by his reaction to her suggestive proposal that he permit himself to indulge in some outward demonstration of his divinity. That was one of the very things he had decided not to do when so recently isolated in the hills. For several hours, Mary was much depressed. She said to James, "I cannot understand him. What can it all mean? Is there no end to his strange conduct?" James and Jude tried to comfort their mother, while Jesus withdrew for an hour's solitude. But he returned to the gathering and was once more lighthearted and joyous. The wedding proceeded with a hush of expectancy. I should explain to you that at the time of the Jordan, the Spirit of God, which indwelt the human Jesus, left him permanently. The technical name for this spirit is an adjuster. And this adjuster received personality in his own name and right. And it was this adjuster which spoke at the Jordan, saying, "This is my beloved son, hearken to me." This personalized adjuster will appear in this story, and it just occurred to me you didn't know who he was. This is the spirit which formerly indwelt Jesus and which no longer does, now that he is enacting the role of a divine son.